power of mind webs. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This is Michael Hansen. The mind web story this time is Restricted Area by Robert Sheckley. Copyright 1953 by the Ziff Davis Publishing Company. Nice looking place, isn't it, Captain? Simmons asked with elaborate casualness, looking through the port. Rather, paradise.
You can't go out yet,
Captain Kilpepper said, noting the biologist's immediate disappointed expression. But, Captain...
No.
Kilpepper looked out the port at the rolling meadow of grass, sprinkled with red flowers that appeared as luscious as it had 2 days ago when they had landed. To the right of the meadow was a brown forest shot through with yellow and orange blossoms. To the left, a row of hills colored in contrasting shades of blue-green. A waterfall tumbled down one of the hills. Trees, flowers, all that sort of thing. The place was undeniably pretty. And it was for that very reason that Kilpepper distrusted it. Experience with two wives and five new ships had taught him that a lovely exterior can conceal almost anything. Kilpepper skimmed the reports. They were the same as the last four groups. Atmosphere breathable and free of dangerous microorganisms. Bacteria count nil. Radar graph all clear. Some form of animal life in the nearby forest, but no energy manifestations. Detection of a large metallic mass, possibly an iron-rich mountain several miles south, noted for further investigation. The reports vaguely annoyed him. He knew from past experience that there was usually something wrong with every planet. It paid to find it at the start before costly accidents resulted. At last, he said,
all right, post a full guard for the time being. Let four men out. No one goes beyond 25 feet of the ship.
He had to let them go. After 16 months in the hot, cramped spaceship, he'd have a mutiny on his hands if he didn't. The air of the unnamed planet was fragrant after the musty, recirculated air of the ship. The breeze from the mountains was light and steady and refreshing. Captain Kilpepper sniffed appreciatively, arms folded across his chest. The four crewmen were walking around, stretching their legs and breathing in great lungfuls of fresh air. The scientific team was standing together, wondering where to begin. Simmons bent down and plucked a spear of grass.
Funny-looking stuff.
Why?
Well, look at it.
The thin biologist held it higher.
Perfectly smooth. Doesn't show any sign of cell formation. Let me see.
He bent over a red blossom.
Hey, we got visitors!
A crewman named Flynn was the first to spot the natives. They came out of the forest and trotted across the meadow to the ship. Captain Kilpepper glanced at the ship. The gunners were ready and alert. He touched his sidearm for reassurance and waited.
Oh, brother.
Aramic murmured. As the ship's linguist, he eyed the advancing natives with intense professional interest. The rest of the men just stared. In the lead was a creature with a neck at least 8 feet long, like a giraffe, and thick, stubby legs, like a hippopotamus. It had a cheerful expression on its face. Its hide was purple, sprinkled with large white dots. Next in line came five little beasts with pure white fur. They were about the size of terriers, and they had an owlishly solemn expression. A fat, red little creature with a green tail, at least 16 feet long, brought up the rear. They stopped in front of the men and bowed. There was a long moment of silence, and then everyone burst into laughter. The laughter seemed to be a signal. The five little ones leaped to the back of the hippo giraffe. They scrambled for a moment, then climbed on each other's shoulders. In a moment, they were balanced, five high, like a team of acrobats. The men applauded wildly. The fat animal immediately started balancing on his tail.
Bravo!
Shouted Simmons. The five furry animals jumped off the giraffe's back and started to dance around the pig.
Hooray!
Morrison, the bacteriologist, called.
The hippo giraffe turned a clumsy somersault, landed on one ear, scrambled to his feet, and bowed deeply.
Captain Kilpepper frowned and rubbed one hand against another. He was trying to figure out some reason for this behavior.
The natives burst into song. The melody was strange, but recognizable as a tune. They harmonized for a few seconds, then bowed and began to roll on the grass.
The crew members were still applauding. Aramek had taken out his notebook and was jotting down the sounds.
All right, crew, back inside.
They gave him reproachful looks.
I'll let some of the other men have a chance.
Regretfully, the men filed back inside. Captain Kilpepper sat down and tried to figure out what was wrong with the planet. Kilpepper spent most of the next day filling out progress reports. In the late afternoon, he put down his pencil and went out for a walk. Have you got a moment, Captain? Simmons asked. There's something I'd like to show you in the forest. On the way, they were accompanied by three natives. These particular three looked like dogs, except for their coloring, red and white, like peppermint candy. Now then, sir, look around. What do you see that strikes you as odd?
Kilpepper looked. The trees were thick-trunked and spaced wide apart, so wide apart, in fact, that it was possible to see the next clearing through them.
Well, you couldn't get lost in here.
It's not that. Come on, look again.
Why, there's no underbrush, Kilpepper stated after walking a few yards further.
There were vines twisting up the sides of the trees covered with multicolored flowers.
Glancing around, Kilpepper saw a bird dart down, flutter around the head of one of the peppermint-colored dogs, and fly away again. The bird was colored gold and silver.
Don't you see anything wrong yet?
Well, only the color scheme. Is there something else?
Look at the trees.
The boughs were laden with fruit. It hung in clumps, all on the lower branches, of a bewildering variety of colors, sizes, and shapes. There were things that looked like grapes, and things that looked like bananas, and things that looked like watermelons, and...
Lots of different species, I guess.
Different species. Look, man, there are as many as 10 different kinds of fruit growing on one branch.
Examining closer, Kilpepper saw it was true. Each tree had an amazing multiplicity of fruit.
And that's just impossible, sir. It's not my field, of course, but I can state with fair certainty that each fruit is a separate and distinct entity. They're not stages of each other.
How do you account for it?
I don't have to, but some poor botanist is going to have his hands full.
They turned and started to walk back.
What were you here for?
Me? I was doing a little anthropological work on the side, wanted to find out where our friends lived. No luck. There are no paths, implements, clearings, anything, not even caves.
Kilpepper didn't think it unusual that a biologist should be making a quick anthropological survey. It was impossible to represent all the sciences on an expedition of this sort. Survival was the first consideration. Biology and bacteriology, then language. After that, any botanical, ecological, psychological, sociological, or any other knowledge was appreciated. 8 or 9 birds had joined the animals, or natives, around the ship when they got back. The birds were brilliantly colored also. Polka dots, stripes, piebalds. There wasn't a dun or gray in the lot. Mate Marina and crewman Flynn trudged through an outcropping of the forest. They stopped at the foot of a little hill. Above them, red and gold birds dipped and sailed, cheeping merrily. The breeze fanned the tall grass and hummed melodiously through the leaves and branches of the nearby forest. Behind them, two of the natives followed. They were horse-shaped, except for their hides of green and white dots.
It's like a bloody circus,
Flynn observed as one of the horses capered a circle around him.
Yeah,
Marina said. They reached the top of the hill and started down, then Flynn stopped.
Look at that!
At the base of the hill, rising slim and erect, was a metal pillar. They followed it up with their eyes. It climbed and climbed, and its top was lost in the clouds. They hurried down and examined it. Closer, the pillar was more massy than they had thought. Almost 20 feet through, Marina estimated. At a guess, he placed the metal as an alloy of steel by its gray-blue color. But what steel, he asked himself, could support a shaft that size? How high would you say those clouds are? Flynn craned his neck. Or they must be half a mile up, maybe a mile. The pillar had been hidden from the ship by the clouds and by its gray-blue color, which blended into the background. I don't believe it. I wonder what the compression strain on this thing is. They stared in awe at the tremendous shaft. Well, I better get some pictures. They unloaded their cameras and snapped several shots of the shaft from 20 feet, and then a shot with Marina for size comparison. And then they sighted up the shaft. What do you figure it is? I'll let the big brains figure it out. It ought to drive them nuts. Back at the ship, Killpepper was squatting in the grass watching Aramek at work. The linguist was a patient man. His sisters had always remarked on his patience. His colleagues had praised him for it, and his students during his years of teaching had appreciated it. Now the backlog of 16 years of self-containment was being called to the front.
Well, we'll try it again, Aramek said.
He flipped through the pages of Language Approach to Alien Grade 2 Intelligences, a text written by himself, and found the diagram he wanted. He opened to the page and pointed. The animal beside him looked like an inconceivable cross between a chipmunk and a giant panda. It cocked one eye at the diagram, the other eye wandering ludicrously around its socket.
Planet, Aramek said, pointing. Planet. Excuse me, Simmons said. I'd like to set up this X-ray gadget here.
Certainly,
Killpepper said, moving to let the biologist drag the machine into place.
Planet, Aramek said again. Elam Vessel Holam Kram,
the chipmunk panda said. Damn it, they had a language. The sounds they made were certainly representational. It was just a question of finding a common meeting ground. Had they mastered simple abstractions? Aramek put down his book and pointed to the chipmunk panda.
Animal,
he said, and waited. Get him to hold still, Simmons said, focusing the X-ray.
That's good. Now a few more.
Animal, Aramek repeated hopefully.
Efo Befo Box. Hofo Tofo Lox. Ramadan Sam Duran Efo Befo Box.
Patience, Aramek reminded himself. Positive attitude. Be cheerful. Faint heart never. He picked up another of his manuals. This one was called Language Approach to Alien Grade 1 Intelligences. He found what he wanted and put it down again, smiling, and held up a finger.
One.
The animal leaned forward and sniffed the finger. Smiling grimly, Aramek held up another finger.
Two.
A third.
Three.
Hogalax,
the animal said suddenly. A diphthong, their word for one?
One,
he said again, waving the same finger.
Verisabraf,
the animal replied, beaming. Could that be an alternate one?
One,
he said again, and the animal burst into song.
Sabbath haveth ulit cram, aragan belagan homus gram.
It stopped and looked at the language approach manual fluttering in the air and at the back of the linguist, who with remarkable patience had refrained from throttling him. After Marina and Flynn returned, Killpepper puzzled over their report. He had the photographs rushed through and studied them with care. The shaft was round and smooth and obviously manufactured. Any race that could put up a thing like that could give them trouble, big trouble. But who had put the shaft up? Not the happy, stupid animals around the ship, certainly.
You say the top is hidden in the clouds?
Yes, sir. The damn thing must be all of a mile high.
Well, go back and take a radar scope, take infrared equipment, and get me a picture of the top of that shaft. I want to know how high it goes and what's on top of it.
Flynn and Marina left the bridge. Kilpepper looked at the still wet photographs for a minute longer, then put them down. He wandered into the ship's lab, vague worries nagging at him. This planet didn't make sense, and that bothered him. Kilpepper had discovered the hard way that there's a pattern to everything. If you can't find it in time, that's just too bad for you. Morrison, the bacteriologist, was a small, sad man. Right now, he looked like an extension of the microscope he was peering into.
You find anything?
I found the absence of something. There isn't an ounce of bacteria on this planet. That's it, sir. The water in the stream is purer than distilled alcohol, and the dirt on this planet is cleaner than a boiled scalpel. The only bacteria are the ones we brought, and they're being killed off.
How?
The air of this place has about 3 disinfecting agents that I've detected, probably a dozen more I haven't. Same with the dirt and water. This place is sterile.
Well, now.
Kilpepper couldn't appreciate the full force of the statement. He was still worried about the steel shaft.
What does all this mean?
I'm glad you asked me that. Yes, I'm really glad you asked me. It means simply that this place does not exist.
Oh, come now.
I mean it. There can't be life without microorganisms. One whole section of the life cycle is missing here.
Unfortunately, it does exist. Have you any other theories?
Yes, but I want to finish these tests first. But I'll tell you one thing. I haven't been able to detect a piece of rock on this planet. And there's no loose rock or stone anywhere around. The smallest stone is about 7 tons.
Well, what does that mean?
Ah, you're wondering too. Excuse me, I want to complete these tests before supper.
Just before sunset, the x-rays of the animals were finished. Kilpepper had another surprise. Morrison had told him the planet couldn't exist. Then Simmons insisted the animals couldn't exist. Just look at these pictures, sir. Look, do you see any organs? The x-rays showed a few bones and 1 or 2 organs. There were traces of a nervous system on some of the pictures, but mostly the animals seemed homogeneous throughout. There isn't enough internal structure to keep a tapeworm going. Now, this simplification is impossible. Now, there's nothing that corresponds to lungs or heart. No bloodstream, no brain, damn little nervous system, and what organs they have don't make sense. I conclude these animals don't exist. Aramaic passed them, swearing softly. Any luck on the language? No. Oh, sorry, I tested them right down to intelligence grade C3BB. That's amoeba class. No response.
Well, perhaps they're just completely brainless.
No, the ability to do tricks shows a certain level of intelligence. They have a language of sorts also and a definite response pattern, but they won't pay any attention. All they do is sing songs.
I think we need supper. Perhaps a slug or two of the old standby, too.
The old standby was much in evidence at supper. After a fifth or two had been consumed, the scientists mellowed sufficiently to consider some possibilities and put together their facts. Item, the natives or animals showed no sign of internal organs, no reproductive or excretive equipment. There seemed to be at least 3 dozen species, not counting birds, and more appearing every day. The same with plants. Item, the planet was amazingly sterile, and acted to keep itself so. Item, the natives had a language, but evidently couldn't impart it to others, nor could they learn another language. Item, there were no small rocks or stone around. Item, there was a tremendous steel shaft rising to a height of at least 0.5 mile, exact height to be determined when the new pictures were developed. Although there was no sign of a machine culture, the shaft was obviously the product of one. Someone must have built it and put it there.
Throw it all together, and what do you got?
I have a theory.
It's a beautiful theory, sir. The way I see it, the planet is man-made, it must be. No race would evolve without bacteria. It was made by a super race. The race who put that steel spire there. They built it for the animals.
Why?
This is a beautiful part. Pure altruism. Look at the natives. Happy, playful, completely devoid of violence, rid of all nasty habits. Don't they deserve a world to themselves? A world where they can romp and play in an eternal summer? These people are here as a reminder, a message to all passing races that men can live in peace.
There's only one flaw in that. The animals could never have evolved naturally. You saw the X-rays.
That's true.
The dreamer struggled briefly with the biologist, and the dreamer lost.
Perhaps they're robots.
That's the explanation I favor. The way I see it, the race that built that steel shaft built these animals, too. They're servants, slaves. Why, they might even think we're their masters.
Where would the real masters have gone?
Well, how the hell should I know that? And where would these masters live? We haven't spotted anything that looks like habitation.
They're so far advanced they don't need machines or houses. They live directly with nature. Then why do they need servants? And why do they build the spire?
That evening, the new pictures of the steel pillar were completed, and the scientists examined them eagerly. The top of the pillar was almost a mile high, hidden in thick clouds. There was a projection on either side of the top, jutting out at right angles to a distance of 85 feet. When Kilpepper woke up the next morning, something didn't feel right. He dressed and went outside. There seemed to be something intangible in the wind. Kilpepper shook his head. He had faith in his premonitions. They usually meant that unconsciously he had completed some process in reasoning. Everything seemed to be in order around the ship. The animals were outside, wandering lazily around. Kilpepper glared at them and walked around the ship. The scientists were back at work trying to solve the mysteries of the planet. Aramic was trying to learn the language from a mournful-eyed green and silver beast that seemed unusually apathetic this morning. Kilpepper thought of Circe. Could the animals be people changed into beasts by some wicked sorcerer? The crew hadn't noticed anything different. They had headed en masse for the waterfall to get in some swimming. Kilpepper assigned two men to make a microscopic inspection of the steel shaft. That worried him more than anything else. Around midday, Aramic, the linguist, walked over. He threw his books one by one against the side of the ship.
I give up. Those beasts won't pay any attention now. They're barely talking, and they've stopped doing tricks.
The giraffe-like animal sat down suddenly. Slowly, he rolled over on his side and lay still. Two of the smaller ones with glossy black fur toppled over.
What's happening now?
I'm afraid I know, Morrison said.
Germs. Captain, I feel like a murderer. I think we've killed these poor beasts. Remember I told you there was no sign of any microorganism on the planet? Think of how many we've introduced. Bacteria streaming off our bodies onto these hosts. Hosts with no resistance, remember?
I thought you said the air had several disinfecting agents.
Evidently, they didn't work fast enough.
The rest of the animals around the ship were falling now and lying quite still. One of the crewmen dashed up, panting. He was still wet from his swim by the waterfall.
Sir, over by the falls, the animals, and that's not all, the waterfall, you know, the waterfall, it stopped, sir. It stopped running.
Get the men down here.
The crewman sprinted back to the falls, and Kilpepper looked around, not sure what he was looking for. He almost had the answer. The brown forest was quiet now, too quiet, and Kilpepper realized that the gentle, steady breeze that had been blowing ever since they landed had stopped. The crewman hurried back from the waterfall, glistening wet. At Kilpepper's order, they piled back into the ship. The scientists remained standing, looking over the silent land. The man who had been examining the shaft came running down the hill, bounding through the long grass as though the devil himself were after them.
What now?
It's a damn shaft, sir. It's turning.
The shaft. That mile-high mass of incredibly strong metal was being turned. Kilpepper could feel the answer taking shape now. There was just one more bit of evidence he needed. One thing more. The animals sprang to their feet. The red and silver bird started to fly again, winging high into the air. The giraffe hippo reared to his feet, snorted, and raced off. The rest of the animals followed him. From the forest, an avalanche of strange beasts poured onto the meadow. At full speed, they headed west, away from the ship.
Get back in the ship!
That did it. Kilpepper knew now, and he only hoped he could get the ship into deep space in time.
Hurry the hell up and get those engines going.
But we still got equipment scattered around, sir. I don't see any need for this.
Man the guns.
Suddenly, there were long shadows in the west.
Captain, we haven't completed our investigation yet.
You'll be lucky if we live through this. Haven't you put it together yet? Close that bay. Get everything tight.
You mean the turning shaft? Oh, all right. I suppose there's some super race.
That turning shaft is a key in the side of the planet. It winds the place up. The whole world is like that. Animals, rivers, wind, everything runs down. Now figure it out. A place where all kinds of wonderful food hangs from the trees, where there's no bacteria to hurt you, not even a sharp rock to stub your toes, a place filled with marvelous, amusing, gentle animals, where everything's designed to delight you. A playground. And the shaft is a key. The place ran down while we made our unauthorized visit, and now someone's winding the planet up again.
Outside the port, the shadows were stretching for thousands of feet across the green meadow.
Hang on!
Kilpepper shouted as he punched the takeoff button.
Unlike the toy animals, I don't want to meet the children who play here. And I especially don't want to meet their parents.
You've heard Restricted Area, a story by Robert Sheckley. Copyright 1953 by the Ziff Davis Publishing Company. I'm Michael Hansen. Technical operation for this program by Rich Grody and Mike Burns.